You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the podcast of the Archaeo Book Club, an online community for lovers of archaeology and books.
Hello and welcome to episode 10 of the Archaeo Book Club podcast. My name is Tilly and I'm here with my co-hosts Judith and Ash.
Hello.
Hiya.
And in this special Bookworms episode, we'll be following up on our discussion from last episode, which, to be honest, could have gone on for multiple episodes, and talking about our literary perspective of the book club's November theme of... prepare yourselves. It belongs in a museum!
Oh my god, Indy, it's you!
I hate snakes. And this...
yeah. I was like sacramental.
We named the dog Indiana.
Go on, Judith, you do it now.
I mean, what, I can't, you know, with my hearing problems, I can't mimic anything.
Okay, anyway, and this month, our book club members have voted to read Ghosts of the British Museum by Noah Ango. Sorry, Noah, if I'm mispronouncing your last name. If you want to see what everyone thinks of the book, come and join the Discord server to join in the discussion. But first of all, so for the three of us, is this a theme, so museums, I guess, that you would often pick to read about in your free time?
Depends, really. I mean, I was saying before we started recording that I have quite a few books, as I'm sure probably you two do, of certain objects or types that are kept in collections, sort of visual records or detailed catalogues, so that I can have a look at things. Mm. I have a first edition copy of Cheetham's Medieval English Alabasters and things like that. But in terms of, well, I got it as a discount. I got it at a discount many years ago at the Leeds International Medieval Congress. It was this display book, and in the day, it was worth more than a student could afford, but they gave me a discount and I walked away with it. So I've never really used it.
I was about to say, it's been useful ever since.
I do look at it occasionally.
Sometimes you just want that book on your shelf, though, you know? You're like, that's my book.
It's a bit of a bit of a prize back in the day, shall we say.
I definitely have a lot of those sorts of random ones. I recently bought a bunch of books about a catalog of needles, like different types of needles, and not even just like bone needle, like sewing needles, but like every single kind of needle you could possibly think of that you could find on a German archaeological excavation. Cool. And then when I was looking at that, they had all these other ones in the same series, which was like a thing of buckles and a thing of buttons and all this kind of stuff. So I now have one on clay pipes and one on needles and one about something else. So yeah, I definitely have a lot of those kinds of books about random collections of things.
Yeah, I think that's the archaeological disposition that you do. You have to have as many little factoid books as possible. Yes. Then you can cross-reference it, you know, whenever you're out in the wild and you see a piece of Scottish white grittyware. And you're like, oh, yes, this is exactly it.
Whip out my book.
I know exactly what this is.
Well, also with my art history hat on, for me, like, I've got a photographic memory, so I will see things and I
Very
will
useful.
Years afterwards, and I will go, I've seen that somewhere before. And then I have books simply not in as advanced a way as you guys, but I will go, where did I see that last 20 years ago, rummage? And I will find things like that. So my husband actually bought me a badge from a really cool artist who does sort of medieval inspired stuff at our local makers market in Norwich Forum. And he brought it home and he was like, hey, this is cool. I got it for you. And I looked at it, I was like, oh, hang on, I know where that came from. And I pulled a book off the shelf and he went, how do you do that?
It's a gift.
So, yeah, that's one of my, and when we play Magic the Gathering on Thursday with our friend, I sometimes find things off cards. I'm like, oh, well, that picture came from this, and I'll pull off one of the catalogue books. Which I'm sure they all really enjoy pausing their game for me to be pedantic about things.
Oh, you would be a fantastic detective, though, Judith. Because
perfect for the museum scenario.
I remember where I, you know, I saw this.
Cool.
An amazing microware analyst, because you wouldn't have to constantly compare against other pictures. I mean, when you say photographic, I'm just curious. Sorry, I'm going down a rabbit hole now. When you say photographic memory, is it that you like remember the sort of outer shape or anything? Or for example, if it was like a microware image with like particular patterns and stuff, would that also be...
I think I'd have to be familiar with microwave images. I mean, I do know what they look like, but I've not seen sufficient of them. If I've seen sufficient of something, I will remember it, and I will remember where something is on the page of a book. So
okay.
I will remember the shape of the paragraph that the reference came from, what it looked like on the page, and whether which side of the page it was, and things like that. I'm not infallible, but it does come in handy. I will... I found things at work before. I've noticed things in the past with some of that. This my official job that I can't really discuss here, but it's nothing to do with archaeology or what I'm trained for, but my ability to recognise has come in handy.
Indeed. I mean, it's a pretty good skill to have in general, I feel. Anyway, sorry, right, that was a...
digression, guys. That was a
different... side quest there. I'm just curious, contemplating how I can use Judith as a tool in my future.
Well, I mean, I'm game for a go, but I need to see enough of it to then see a pattern.
Yeah, no, okay, yeah. So it's not that you'd be like, oh, yes, I've seen this once and I can remember that is...
If I'd seen it once before, I would probably remember it.
Okay. Well, we'll have to do some tests. Anyway, but sorry, listeners. We're changing the theme of this podcast to random things that Tilly wants to learn more about.
Hell, let's just do that. There's loads of stuff I'm sure all of us want to learn.
Random facts that we all know. But yeah, so I mean, it's sort of, I think there's so many books about that, right? And about like collections and museum things. I mean, one of the books that I quite enjoy, even though, as we talked about last episode, there's a lot of problems surrounding certain museums like the British Museum and other museum institutions. One of the books I really like from it is the 100 Around the World in 100 Objects that came from
the museum.
And that is really, even though it shows how problematic it is, because it shows how many of the objects come from other places in the world, they probably weren't taken from very well. But it is really interesting. And I like those kinds of books as well that sort of show you different objects and different things and tell you the stories and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes it is just actually quite nice, especially if like you're a medievalist. I think you get quite some nice showy things occasionally, like Opus Anglicanum embroidery or illumination manuscripts. It's quite nice to just turn the pages and go,
yeah, it looks pretty.
Pretty.
Yeah. And how about things like fiction?
See, this is where I struggle with. I think it's one of those things that even when we started this book club, like about how archaeology is represented in fiction, I find exactly the same thing with museums. I often think of the fictional ones like The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, and like it's always like a mystery and a discovery, and then there's someone that's been murdered in the museum.
There's a government conspiracy.
You steal the Declaration of Independence, that kind of stuff. Do you know what I mean? And it's always a bit, it is compelling, but it's sort of the same tropes over and over again, but also very incorrect ones. Because museum workers and curators, they always live such exciting lives in fiction.
Yeah.
Well, in reality, it's bug traps in the cold stores.
Yeah, exactly. Checking the bug traps and making sure that spiders aren't losing all their legs.
Or they do, and you're just like, oh, I can't do anything.
You're like,
about
no.
Oh, no. I have to watch this little thing suffer.
I think it's the eternal taxidermy collection, because I know most local museums, somebody's given them thousands of stuffed parrots, and they do.
I realized my fear of like big cats in the stores in the Glasgow Museum stores, because we went in and I just saw two glinting eyes staring at me, and I was like, oh my god, what the fuck is that? Sorry. I was like, what is that? And they turned on the lights and it was all these taxidermy tigers, and I was like, it was horrible. I hated it. I was like, I can't do this. This is a lion tiger. It was horrible.
I have a memory of going to a local museum in Wells in Somerset. I think it's Somerset at Wells is in, years ago, and there actually being a huge sign over the entrance basically saying, please no more taxidermy.
Yeah.
That actually reminds me of, I was thinking, oh, I don't actually read that much with museums. And then the more I thought about it afterwards, the more I realised, actually, I read loads of fiction which features museums and collections that I didn't even realise. Like the Veronica Speedwell mysteries that I think I've spoken about in earlier episodes of this one, that I would highly recommend for anyone who loves a sort of badass heroine and adventure, and kind of it's very sort of Victorian steampunk-esque. And it's the main premise is that they are doing up the collection of one of these London aristocrats, and he's basically got this massive collection of stuff, and they have to try and organize it into a exhibition, and that's their like full-time job. And one of the guys is a taxidermist, so that's how
I guess Persuasion by A.S. Byatt as well, which is about researchers going through collections of somebody's writing. And I mean, that is, it's a bit more tenuous, but that is probably one of the less sensationalized versions of sort of looking at a collection in fiction. But generally, I would agree with Ash that a lot of it is it's definitely mystery based.
And it's the different ones. It's either the sort of thriller one, like you were, what did you say? The Da Vinci Code and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's ones like, sort of Miss Marple, you know, Hercule Poirot style, and then they're found in a museum, and then it's, you know,
they find an object that in the museum that's going to ruin the world, and it's been sitting in the dusty collections this whole time, and then someone stole it.
Device.
Yeah, and it was like that. What was that book that we read that we collectively disliked?
Oh, there's been a few.
It was like, it was on motorbikes.
The Ark Files.
That was very pseudo-archaeology.
Shall we say.
And I think that's why I like, if I'm going to read something about a museum, it's usually nonfiction.
Yeah, I think the ones that I enjoy about it are usually ones where it's the museum's kind of the setting, but it's not the main point of the story, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it like gives the background context, but it's not the main, like a main player, and that means that actually usually it's done quite well because it's like an interesting background, you know, and like an interesting side story. But it's not the main quest in that respect.
Seeing that though, I am currently reading Her Night at the Museum by Bryn Donovan. Anyone has seen that? Like it's basically like a curator. You mean
like a museum, like a book version of the film? Or is that
knight, like a K. K?
A K knight. Like a knight.
Like a royal knight.
What? That's an excellent pun. What, like, I genuinely didn't.
You didn't click for you, did it?
And you love called a pun in a title, Tilly.
You do.
Love a good pun.
Well, he's called Sir Griffin de Beaufort.
Oh, lovely.
I know, right?
Oh, dear.
But basically, he comes to life. And she's a curator at a museum who's she might be actually a restoration artist or something.
Okay.
Cool. And she's basically restoring his statue, which is like a whole thing, I think. A lot of statues come to life in fiction with museums as well.
True. Yeah, because there was another one that I can't remember what it's called, but it was a book that I saw and I bought, and it's on my shelf at home, but I don't have the photographic memory, so I can't remember it. But it was about a woman who basically goes and this Venus statue comes to life, but only for her. So she just goes there every night and has conversations with this Venus statue as well, which I also think is quite interesting. But I think, I feel like as with everything that we've talked about in the book club, it's done well in fiction, for example, when you can tell when the author has some background in it. Or
has asked.
Has asked or has done their research well. Like, you can tell when they're good at researching. Because it's
definitely.
Or when they actually work in the field as well.
Yeah, exactly. Because, there's just sort of details. And I find that the best ones are indeed the ones where it's just background setting rather than the like a thriller or something, you know. Like, the thriller ones, it's hardly ever done well, really.
Because they prioritize the suspense over the accuracy of the museum.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think the only one that I've like read which could be counted kind of as a thriller, although it's not, well, it's sort of on the edge of a thriller, which are the Vicky Bliss mysteries by Elizabeth Peters, and there's one, Street of the Five Moons, and that's like set around forgeries and art thieves and museums and that kind of thing. But again, you can tell that Elizabeth Peters, who's the author, like, knows her stuff and has done the research and has that experience.
Yeah. That's cool.
Okay, well, let's just have a very quick pause. And then when we can come back, we're going to be sharing our own recommendations for this theme. So, I mean, we've mentioned quite a few books already, but we're going to be mentioning even more. So bear with us. Welcome back. I want to just quickly say, in the break, I just quickly looked up what that museum one with the Venus statue is called. It's called When the Museum is Closed by Emmy And it does look like a lot of fun. It's basically, it's her job is to converse with this Venus statue, and then like drama ensues. Anyway. So, welcome back, everyone. So, as those of you who listen to the podcast are already very familiar with, but for those new to the podcast, we, the three of us, have very different backgrounds in terms of our kind of history and archaeology knowledge, but we also have quite different backgrounds and different wishes, not wishes, wants, desires, preferences. There we go. Sorry.
It's like, what are you talking
about? My thesaurus is not working today.
Yes. No
wants, wishes in life. I mean, that too, but different preferences when it comes to reading and slightly different approaches to reading and very different reading tastes. So we thought it would be fun to share a book from our own library that's linked in some way with archaeology or history and this month's theme, so that you can add even more to that already slightly swaying stack that is your TBR. So, what books do we have to share this month? Judith, perhaps you can go first.
Okay, so I'm going with a middle grade book. So that is 11 to 14 years in the States. That would be middle grade. And it's called Me, Frida, and the Secret of the Peacock Ring. And it's all set in the Frida Kahlo Museum in Mexico.
Cool.
Okay, so I shall tell you a little bit about it. A locked room, a stolen treasure, a mysterious challenge. Paloma Marquez is traveling to Mexico City, birthplace of her deceased father, for the very first time. She's hoping that staying in Mexico will help her unlock memories of their all too brief time together. While in Mexico, Paloma meets Lizzie and Gail, who present her with an irresistible challenge. The siblings want her to help them find a valuable ring that once belonged to the beloved Mexican artist Frida Kahlo. Finding the ring means a big reward and the thanks of the whole country. What better way to honour her father than returning a priceless piece of jewellery that once belonged to his favourite artist? But the brother and sister have a secret. Do they really want to return the ring, or are they after something else entirely?
Oh my God.
So I want to say, I just realised from our last discussion that this one is indeed playing into the mystery genre. Wow. And in fact, it has a story within a story in terms of the heroine loves reading kind of junior detective novels.
Ah, nice.
But the clever thing about this book, and the reason I'm particularly recommending it, it blew me away in terms of it is for youngsters, but it teaches art history throughout. Nice. And it's really involved in like why a museum and sort of Mexican art belongs in Mexico. It's all about critical thinking. It's all about learning to trust your gut, and not in a dramatic way, but like, you know, learning to trust what your instincts are. And it's just the right age for that sort of point where the 11 to 14 age group is where most children are beginning to sort of think, you know, a little bit independently, trying to learn who they are, how they feel about things independent of their parents. And it just uses all of that. It's amazing in the way it's constructed. It also has brilliant sort of disability rep in terms of discussing Frida Kahlo's own journey with disability and pain. So it's absolutely, it's a great book. I would recommend it. Get it for your children, especially because it has been the subject as well of an isolated book challenge in Florida, US, because Frida Kahlo was a member of the Communist Party and was pro-life. So obviously, although none of that's mentioned, and this is a propaganda piece, according to certain political groups in the States, but it's a great book. I am going to be giving my copy away to friends' children who are just coming up to the right age for it. It's full of adventure and there's drama, but it's also about learning about art and other people's perspectives and how museums are run and undercover art markets. It's brilliant. Anyway,
that sounds amazing.
That sounds really good.
Really great fun. I would, get it for your kids, guys. If you're interested in getting your kids into museums and art and with a bit of fun and kind of teen adventure, you know, away from the grown-ups, then this is a great book. Can't speak too highly of it, really.
And I assume the author is from Mexico?
Yes, she's a Latinx author. She's an award-winning author of several well-known children's or novels, including one called Letio Out Loud, which won a prize. And she's also adapted Encanto and Coco, the Disney Pixar films, into novels.
Oh my God.
And she started writing I know, it's great, isn't it? She started writing stories featuring Latinx characters when she was 9 years old because she wanted books that where she felt seen and that reflected her friends and community. Amazing. And she has actually visited repeatedly Casa Azul, which is Frida Kahlo's house, which is where the National Museum is now in Mexico. And so that's where it's set, in a real museum that you can visit, and they have a website. So yeah, it's great. And she's really done her research on it. And she describes the rooms, the different galleries in the museum in it, where the action takes place. And those are real galleries in that real museum in Mexico. So yeah, go find out about Frida Kahlo and Mexican heritage and art history and learning to think for yourself. It's great.
Got everything you could want in a book.
Definitely. That's a good one for a Christmas list.
I think.
It definitely is. I mean, I would have, this wasn't published when I was a kid, but I would have absolutely lupped it up about the 11 to 14 age group. It's just got that.
It sounds like something I would have read.
It's like leaning into its Nancy Drew roots, but it's also bringing in those conversations about culture and looking at things and then looking again and learning. So it's great. Yeah.
Excellent. Very cool. How about your book, Ash?
So I'm still firmly into spooky season, even though this is November. So I've gone with The Mummy, which is part of the Ramses the Dam series by Anne Rice.
Is this the one... No, this isn't the one that the famous, the 1999 classic featuring Brendan Fraser.
This was published in 1998, actually. So it is around that time that there was some sort of fascination with Egypt again, which is like part of, I think, Anne Rice's like influence, because you get this sense in the book of the Egyptomania that came about in the 19th century and even earlier. And then again, it's reflected in the late 90s. I think there was something about Egypt that everyone was sort of obsessed with, which comes across quite a lot. But no, this is not, it technically is a mummy, but it's Ramses. Not him. I was originally going to go with Discovery of Witches, but by Deborah Harkness. But then I thought, but it was it's a Bodleian Library. And I was thinking, this is quite a good one for colonial collecting and how museums and artifacts are handled, especially when the artifact is living. And I really liked that. So I'll tell you the blurb. Ramses the Great has reawakened in opulent Edwardian London. Having drunk the elixir of life, he is now Ramses the Damned, doomed forever to wander the earth, desperate to quell hungers that can never be satisfied. He becomes the close companion of a voluptuous, I love that bit, heiress, Julie Stratford.
Defining factor.
I know, right? And his cursed past again propels him towards disaster. He is tormented by searing memories of his last reawakening at the behest of Cleopatra, his beloved queen of Egypt. And his intense longing for her, undiminished over the centuries, will force him to commit an act that will place everyone around him in the grievous danger.
Drama. Drama.
On the surface, it doesn't feel like it's anything to do with museums, but actually, it is. It's basically, it's kind of museum adjacent. So the story sort of opens with the excavation of Ramses' tomb, and then it sort of transfers into that British colonial, as I said before, like echo of the Egypt mania and to the sphere of colonialism and how people are displaying objects. So there's a really key scene of how his whole sarcophagus is taken into somebody's house as part of their small collection, you know, of their curiosities, and displays them as an object of fascination, not necessarily a person. So it kind of contextualizes, I like the idea of that, it contextualizes the life of the collection of a museum. And then obviously when he reawakens, he's a living person at that point. Yeah. So there's that the kind of atmosphere of it is the very gothic opulence and London museums, Egyptian tombs, it's artifacts, it's visual, it's lush, it's Anne Rice. Probably
I was about to say, I mean, Anne Rice, like, it must be good.
It's so good. But actually she stopped writing them. I remember reading this in the early 2000s, so probably like 2008 or something like that. And I loved it. But she didn't bring any more out because she changed religions and she decided this was like not right to her to talk about. So then she restarted because she changed her religion again. So she restarted the series in 2017. And then the last one was actually published posthumously after her death. So in 2022. So I have yet to finish the series, which I'm definitely going to do because I've been rereading them and I was like, oh my God, that's so good. But it is really, it's a gothic kind of idea of what colonial, like earlier Edwardian London would have been like through the eyes of a man who was born in ancient Egypt.
That's very cool. And is he the mummy in terms of like that people know that he's a mummy?
Yes, everyone knows he's a mummy.
Okay.
Most, I think it starts off with Julie Stratford knowing he's a mummy, but like he awakens and I'm pretty sure he's like kind of decayed. And then it's sort of that classic The Mummy thing, but it is quite a sweeping romance in the first one.
Nice.
And then progressively gets a bit more like darker and stuff. But yeah, it's very good. I would recommend, plus it's Anne Rice.
Love Anne Rice. But again, interesting that we're still in that sort of dark, not necessarily mystery, but like action kind of thrillery, like sort of.
Yeah.
Action like around it.
Yeah, so it is, and it sort of poses the question about whether, you know, we like a romance is, are they acts of devotion? So as collecting in our museums, are they acts of devotion or the acts of possession?
Yeah,
and I think point.
Yeah, and there's something really cool about that, especially when you put it in the context of our museums now. Like, why are we holding on to a lot of things? What should we repatriate things? Do objects have agency? Do they have their own lives? Like, you know, lots of questions that we talk about all the time in archaeology in this cool gothic setting.
Oh, that sounds very good.
I'm glad you filled in what happened to Anne Rice, because I remember all of her books on the bookshelves, I don't know, before I went to university, and then they kind of, not vanished, but there seemed to be a new one every year at one point, and then there wasn't.
She just, I think she became like born again Christian, and then she dropped Ramses the Damned, which to my teenage heart, I was broken. I was like, what do you mean I can't read the next ones? But now I can. And then she came back. It was like guns swinging, like swords, whatever, because fire blazing. Because then she did like a shifter romance and everyone was like, what? So then, yeah, she went back to kind of, I think, more pagan beliefs and stuff. So I think she kind of had that. I think it was her daughter had died as well, which I think you see in Interview with the Vampire, that kind of reflected in there. So there was a lot of question about life and why and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, she had a really interesting life.
Well, I think this month's episodes we might actually have surprisingly similar books, because my one's also like a mystery actiony one set in 1800s.
So wow. Same brave wave.
So we're sort of all, I think all of the three books are going to be kind of linked in terms of like mystery action adventure thing set in a sort of colonial setting. So I went for Deeds of the Disturber by Elizabeth Peters, otherwise known as Barbara Mertz. And this is one of the ones, this is book 5 in the Amelia Peabody series. And interestingly enough, we're currently doing an Amelia Peabody read-along in the book club, and we are up to book 5. So we are reading this one this month, which I'm really excited about because it's about museums. So it's fate. It's all come together. So the blurb is, can fear kill? There are those who believe so, but Amelia Peabody is sceptical. A respected Egyptologist and amateur sleuth, Amelia has foiled felonious schemes from Victoria's England to the Middle East, and she doubts that it was a 19th dynasty mummy's curse that caused the death of a night watchman in the British Museum. The corpse was found sprawled in the mummy's shadow, a look of terror frozen on the guard's face. What or who killed the unfortunate man is a mystery that seems too intriguingly delicious for Amelia to pass up, especially now that she, her dashing archaeologist husband Emerson, and their precocious son, Ramses, are back on Britain's shores. But a contemporary curse can be as lethal as one centuries old, and the foggy London thoroughfares can be as treacherous as the narrow, twisting alleyways of Cairo after dark, when a perpetrator of evil deeds sets his murderous sights on his relentless pursuer, Amelia Peabody. So yeah, it's like a classic Amelia Peabody. I mean, if you've read, I don't know, you may know that we read the first Amelia Peabody book, Crocodile on a Sandbank, last year, I think.
It was almost a year ago, I think.
Yeah, it was mad. For our theme, Ancient Egypt. So we are familiar with Amelia Peabody. And as I say, we're doing a read-along of the rest of Elizabeth Peters' books in that series at the moment. But this one, again, so it's set in a museum. It's set in the British Museum. They're back in London. Of course, it has all these kind of ongoing intrigues and everything surrounding it. But you can really tell, A, that Elizabeth Peters knows her stuff. Like, she is so, you know, she has a PhD in Egyptology, and you can tell. She really knows all the details of what was happening at this time in the world of Egyptology. But what's also really interesting, the further through the Amelia Peabody series you go, the more it grapples with this concept of kind of colonialism and colonial identity, because at the very beginning of the series, Amelia as a character is quite British in terms of like, oh, good old Britain, and we're helping the country, and, you know, da, and everything. And Emerson, her husband, is very much, the British are fools, and what the hell do we think we're doing coming into this country? And you can see that sort of slight clash of concepts kind of coming together more the further through the series you go. And I think this one's quite an interesting one, because from what I remember anyway, like I say, I'm rereading it at the moment, this one deals a lot more with that idea of like, yeah, what should be kept in museums, and what is it to possess the culture of a country, and who should have what cultural object, and who does it belong to, and that kind of thing. So yeah, kind of similar to the other two that we've talked about a little bit. And also, you know, her son's called Ramses. So
I know, I'd seen that and I was like, oh my gosh, we're definitely thinking the same thing. I have one really important question, which we ask for every single Amelia Peabody book. Does Emerson's chest.
Yeah, that's the hairy chest feature. We want to know.
I mean, I'm trying to remember if it actually explicitly features. I'm not sure it necessarily does, but there's
it's
definitely
always there,
a lot of
lingering.
There's definitely a lot of buttons being ripped off shirts. Let's put it that way. So
there you go.
Yeah, it works.
Lucky, lucky Amelia.
But it's interesting, like you're saying, the sort of Egyptology fever. And when you were mentioning Cleopatra in your one, it actually reminded me of another one that I could have done, which was What the River Knows by Isabel Ibáñez, which is also all about the stealing of artifacts from Egypt and that kind of thing. So yeah, a lot of... So, yeah, I mean, usually I end this section by saying, well, here are a few very different examples, but actually these three are very similar, but, you know, they're slightly different in their background. So here's a couple of ones for you to try out if you're interested in pursuing this theme further. So on that note, that about wraps it up for this episode. To find out what our next theme will be, make sure to keep an eye on our Instagram or on our Discord server. And if you've been reading along, or if you still want to read along, there is still time, make sure to come along and join our free community Discord server to chat with fellow book club members. All of the links for how to join the club, as well as a reading list and any other links of interest, are included in the show notes. For now, as always, happy reading, and bye everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Archaeo Book Club podcast, produced by the APN. If you want to join the club or just get more information, check out our website at www.archaeobookclub.com.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.